accession number 28361, reel 63.
General Julian Thompson, reel 63. Now, you were saying that you were trying to stop redundancy and duplication within the special forces, and that Mike Gray has finally managed to sort that out. Another question is, how do you actually recruit people for that specific role? Were they volunteering for it, or were they simply being tasked for it?
No, the SBS were selected but from volunteers from within the Royal Marines only. In fact, I was the first chap to bring in an outsider when I learnt that a naval submarine engineer wanted to join the SAS, which they're allowed to do. The Navy, anyone's allowed to volunteer for the SAS. And I said, what a waste. Why doesn't he join the SBS? He said, well, I never realised I could. And I said, well, you know, here's a chap who's an engineer. He's a nuclear engineer. He's a submariner. So he's used to operating in this sort of thing anyway. He knows quite a lot about engineering. He might be quite a useful chap if we ever had to take over a nuclear-driven ship, for example. So I brought him in.
Of course, another nightmare, which is frequently raised by the prophets of doom, is the idea of terrorists hijacking a shipload of nuclear waste.
Exactly, yeah. Well, that was one of the things that... I'll tell you about that in a minute, actually, because we were involved in the movement of nuclear waste around the country. that was one of the things we were responsible for doing. But to answer your question about that, and they then passed a selection course. And one of the stumbling blocks in those days was the thing called the diving aptitude test. And a lot of people failed it because there's a world of difference between diving off the coast of Egypt in beautiful, clear, blue water where you can see everything and being put through the diving aptitude in a clay pit outside pool where you can't see your hand in front of your face. And a lot of people got claustrophobia, couldn't cope with it, and they failed it. And so they failed getting into the SBS. The reaction then, a lot of them, was to leave the Royal Marines and join the parachute regiment and join the SAS. So we were losing a lot of good, not a lot, we were losing some good chaps because they couldn't pass the diving aptitude, which was always done first. There's no point in putting them through a year's training and then doing their diving aptitude test on day 365 and saying, sorry, mate, you're on your way. So that was the volunteer. Now, in addition, we also ran a company of backup troops up in Scotland, belonging to a thing called Comacchio Group, which still exists in the Royal Marines as the Fleet Security Group. And they had several roles, one of which was to guard the base at Faz Lane, the nuclear submarine base. They had a backup role in that the SBS would have secured the oil platform, but some of these platforms are huge, so you need to flood them with large numbers of well-trained troops who aren't going to be sufficiently expert to climb the legs of oil rigs, but can do fast roping down from helicopters and act with the SB. Now, another role these guys had was escorting nuclear weapons and nuclear waste around the countryside. I don't know if you know, but there's quite a lot of movement of nuclear waste and nuclear weapons around this country.
It has to be.
It has to be. And the biggest threat was not so much the terrorist threat of them hijacking it, though that was on the card. The biggest threat was what I used to call the red face threat. In other words, you know, the Daily Mirror would hijack them and say, look how easy it is. We took the role over from the RAF regiment, who we discovered used to use the same route, the same pubs every time. So the hotels, the Pig and Whistle in Bradford would say, oh, you're moving a load of nuclear waste today. What do you want for breakfast, Charlie? It was ridiculous.
Poor field security.
Yeah. So we were responsible for doing that. And of course, we also put people on board some of the nuclear waste ships in the role I was describing,
yes,
as to prevent them being hijacked.
They're armed anyway, aren't they, those ships? They're effectively armed merchants.
Yes, indeed. So we did in the early days put people on board. I don't think they do it anymore. So that's, to answer your question, yes, they were all volunteers and highly selected. It was a great competition to get into SBS and a very high failure rate.
Another role which has been developed, I think, by SBS is in countering drug smuggling.
Yeah.
Was that in the wind at the time, or did that develop later?
No, that developed later. That grew out of another thing that, that we did, but it wasn't done by the SBS, it was done by the landing craft wing, of countering illegal border crossers in Hong Kong who used to come in fast boats, or anything from junks to fast boats. And so there was a team of guys out there, and that's what led to the development of some of these extremely fast chase boats. I mean, one of the principles I operated on, I don't know whether it still operates, was that you didn't need to pass the SBS selection to drive a boat. What I wanted was expert boat drivers. And so I used landing craft crews to do that, who do nothing but drive boats. Mm-hmm. And I remember a naval officer looking over the side of a RFA one day, watching an anti-hijack thing, where there was a boat, and this RFA was plunging along at full chat, doing about 20 knots in quite a seaway. And this guy was keeping his rib just there, and guys were climbing up the side. And he said to me, and he said, these boys are the best boat handlers in the Navy. I said, yeah, they're Royal Marines. But again, I used to say to the SAS, you have a thing called a boat troop, which does 3 months a year and then does something else. I said, I have guys who've been driving boats for 12 years. You're not going to tell me that they're not better than your bloody boat troop people. And of course they were. And you don't need to spend a huge amount of money and time training a guy to badge him to be a boat driver. And so my philosophy in the SBS was you badge only the people that have to do the specialised jobs, and the non-badge people can be the signallers, the boat drivers, the truck drivers, you name it, the backup. So effectively you have a sort of pretty small point of the spear, but the shaft is pretty important as well, because without the shaft the point doesn't get there. But you don't need to have the shaft badged and trained, just trained in their own skill.
Yeah. Well, there's always a tension between versatility and specialisation
in
the military force.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's the way we operated.
You were saying that amongst the other things that were in your sphere of responsibility were the reserves.
Yes.
Did any issues come up about the reserves while you were in post at
the
Portsmouth?
There was always this debate as to what their role was, whether it was to provide formed subunits or provide individuals.
Replacements.
Mm. It's now, I mean, as far as the Royal Marines are concerned, they provide replacements. Mm. And they provide a lot in Iraq, and they provide them still. Because it made much more sense to do that. Because there simply isn't time in a reserve training cycle to do any form of training above, I would say, sort of section level, quite frankly. I mean, you can do sort of platoon training, but to try and take a whole... battalion training is out of the window, in my opinion, and company training is just possible because of the time they've got available to train. I suppose that was the main issue. What was interesting was going round the various places. I mean, you know, going to Newcastle. The guys there were totally different from the chaps in Bristol. It really is regional, and the chaps in Scotland. You know, it's sort of tribalism taken to its ultimate conclusion. Even though the people themselves may not be jocks, they may just be working up there. And
they get acculturated.
And they all had their different reasons for joining. And of course, they were, in those days, we're talking the early 80s, of quite high unemployment in certain areas of the country, and particularly around Newcastle. Why did they join? Did they join because they wanted the money? Or what? And quite honestly, I find it was interesting that the best reservists were the guys who were already in quite a busy job, not people who joined because they couldn't think of anything better to do at that time.
Were you able to get out and about a lot, or were you
stuck
in your...
No, I got out a lot because the thing ran itself, really. I mean, there wasn't much to do, sign bits of paper occasionally. So going out to watch reserve training, and of course I also had you know, landing craft training, the recruit training, all that, so I'd go out and watch, and I had all the officer training. I had all the training in the Royal Marines, so though it was small in scale, it was diverse, you know, because one day I'd be watching young officers training, the next day I'd be watching lance corporals training, or watching landing craft crews training, or watching the SBS training. So each activity was small, but there was a great spread of different kinds of, I mean, from watching carpenters being trained, or printers, or you know, tradesmen, or drivers, going down to the landing craft trials unit at North Devon, where they used to try out new kinds of landing craft. Again, a sort of miniature bijou training places, but jolly interesting and doing good work, and the only ones in the country.
Did you introduce any significant changes in any of the training?
No. I suppose I don't think I did. The two changes I made, and they're pretty minor, really. One was to change the way that the SBS sorted themselves out in August. When I started the job, the SBS was described as a special boat squadron, yes, and consisted of sections, which was a hangover from the Second World War. And I said, you know, to the outside world, a section is 8 men commanded by a corporal sitting in the back of a warrior, not 16 men divided into 4 four-man patrols, which is what they actually are. I said, we'll go to an organization that people understand, and we'll up the thing, and we'll call the special boat squadron the special boat service, and we'll call the subunit squadrons, and then we'll have troops at the bottom of that. So we'll go like the SAS, so that people understand what we're talking about. And it fitted having a reorganization, because we were doing some relocation of people and re-rolling, so it actually sort of melded in quite well. The other thing I got involved in, which is not changing anything, was home defense.
Wow.
Because I was the sort of Royal Marines home defense guru or commander. I didn't have a patch, in the sense that I wasn't like a district. In those days, they used to have major generals in charge of districts. So I didn't have a district, but I was responsible for the Royal Marine response to home defense tasks, of which there were quite a large number. There was safety of harbors, which involved some special force tasks. There was the guarding of certain key points, which involved people who had reached a certain stage of training in the training establishments. So that, for example, if a man was in his last week of training and the bell went, you know, we went to war, World War III started, he'd join a commando. I'm just using that as an example. A man who was only reached week 16 was not deemed fit to join a commando, but he could stand with a rifle outside a key point.
Yeah.
So he went and did that.
God.
Everyone else went on with his training. And then you brought recruits in, and eventually the system caught up with itself. You know, after 5 years of war, the system caught up with itself, was the theory. And I was in charge of all that bit and how that worked, which meant I had to work to all the districts in the country in which I had key points, which were quite a number. I had to work to the naval port commanders who were going to use some of my guys, and I had to work to certain utility, you know, nuclear power station people and that sort of thing, who I might have to provide key point guards at.
Did that involve liaising with the British Nuclear Police?
Yes. Yes.
What were they like to deal with?
Well, I only dealt with them once, because we did one home defence section. You know, home defence was very much a sort of on the back burner,
yeah,
and it just happened that my time coincided with a major home defence exercise.
Presumably that would also bring in civil defence.
Indeed.
With town clerks. And
indeed. I mean, I used to go to meetings every two or three, no, more than that, I suppose about three times a year, to talk civil defence.
Yeah.
With, I mean, it was done on a centralised basis, again, because I had no patch, but my chaps were going to various patches, so I'd end up, and I can't remember, there's a coordinating, the command headquarters that I dealt with was Southeast District, on the basis it was easier to deal with one than deal with the whole bloody lot when it came to sort of procedures. And it was there that I discovered, I hope I'm not treading on your toes, that what a moribund organisation the Home Office is compared with the MOD. You know, everything was too difficult. And we need this. And this had been on the list for 20 years, and it was, you know, all too difficult again. We couldn't afford it anyway.
You got an instinctively negative reaction.
I got an instinctively negative reaction, really. Mm. And then when you dealt with a sort of AUS level chap from the from the Home Office, he was not the high flying, sparky, make it all happen AUS that one was used to dealing with in the MOD.
Who were you working to in this role? Were you working to Home Office, or were you working to MOD, or
no? My boss. In the chain of command was CNC Nav Home, Commander in Chief, you know, the naval equivalent to UKLF.
Yes.
But I also had sort of, you know, because I was in this peculiar position, I had dotted lines to sync UKLF as well.
Yeah.
So I'd go to his briefings. I'd go to both because I was actually had a foot in each camp. But when it came to a sort of, you know, because the Royal Marines are part of the Navy, when it came to sort of who I belong to.
The unpecked line.
The unpecked line was to Sync Nav Home, as he was called then. I don't know, there isn't such a person now.
No. Did Sync Nav Home have an active interest in this field of activity?
It depended who the chap was. Ah. And it was personalities. I mean, when it was Desmond Cassidy, the answer was no, he couldn't have cared less. When it was his successor, it was a nice chap called Peter something, who I knew because I'd served with his brother, who was a gunner, was a horse gunner. Then it worked. Yeah, he took an interest. Peter Stanford, or the Admiral Sir Peter Stanford, and Bill Stanford had been a horse gunner, parachute horse gunner. I'd been his. He'd been my grade 2 staff, so when I did my first staff job, so I knew him, you see, helped.
So you've got three separate hats to wear.
Yeah.
And two of them, I would suggest, are really quite cognate, aren't they? I mean, the idea of home defence and counter-terrorism are sort of
sure.
ought to be integrated.
Yeah. Yes.
Because what sort of threat were you thinking of when you were designing these?
What, the home defence stuff?
Yes.
Well, that was given to me. That was given in the sense that I mean, it wasn't something I spent a lot of time on, home defence. I spent if I was asked to describe how I sliced my sort of pie chart of activity up, I probably gave the biggest bit in terms of thought and effort and original thought to what was the smallest force, i.e. the SBS, because it was a growing thing. And we were having to do things like set up a headquarters in my headquarters, which was able to react for a day, which there wasn't one when I took over.
So that was the area where you had live issues.
I had live issues.
Resolved.
That had to be resolved all the time. And you never, and things happened in the sense that I would suddenly be told, we need to mount a surveillance operation on the fishing fleet in Ullapool, because we think, I mean, we're talking now, the Cold War's still on.
Yes.
There is a penetration there by agents. It's probably highly classified, but I don't care. So we've got to have a covert watch on it. So who does it? The SBS. And that's got an operation mounted from my headquarters. The communication's got to be worked out. How do you get the guys there? What are you going to do? What's the plan? Who are they reporting to? The MI5. So you're having to set up something literally cold off the hoof. So my pie chart of activity is 50% probably on the smallest thing in terms of bodies. Then probably training is I don't know, two-thirds of what's left, and one-third of what's left is the reserves, who tend to run themselves because they have a routine and the issues don't come up so much. Training is much more time-consuming because there are matters of policy to be decided. There's all the sort of issues that go with training, like bullying and standards of instruction and opt-out rates and why are so many people leaving and why are so many people getting injuries and getting chucked out and all that sort of thing. So those are all fairly time-consuming events, whereas the reserves run themselves.
Yeah. Now, you're mentioning the business of monitoring what's going on in the fishing fleet and reporting to MI5 and so forth. In this rather complex area of assessing an overall concept of the potential terrorist threat and then identifying specific potential actual threats, there are a number of agencies competing.
Sure.
You've got MI5, presumably MI6, you've got Special Branch. How was the liaison to ensure deconfliction done for all that? Because otherwise you can get in each other's way,
it was done, as far as we were concerned. What we were worried about was the Spetsnaz. What actually they were worried about was the Spetsnaz threat.
The raid of Iki coming in.
Yeah, was you know, these guys doing recces.
Yeah.
And in fact, our chain of command was to the DIS, the Defence Intelligence Staff.
Yes.
Who then, it was their responsibility to deconflict all the other people. And they tasked us. You see, what would happen is that the MI5 would say, we want someone with the sort of skills the SBS can bring, like pretending to be a lobster pot or something, whatever it was. We weren't being asked to sort of go in and sort them out or anything like that. Yeah. All we were being asked to do was to do surveillance. You know, what are they doing?
Yeah.
Taking photographs of them or videos of them or whatever. Then that information was passed up through the DS, and then who dealt with it? I have no idea. Mm. I mean, I didn't need to know. You know, whether they then said okay, and the local plod appeared and sort of fingered their collars and said, yeah, you know, bugger off, or whether they were taken away and shot by MI5, I have no idea. We weren't getting involved in that.
The Warsaw Treaty Organization and its members are obviously the most dangerous potential threat.
Yeah.
Perhaps the most immediate active threat
was the IRA.
The IRA.
Well, we didn't get involved in that. We did, but only again in two areas. One was providing people for 14int.
Yeah.
And having provided them, of course, they were there. They were run by 14int, not by me.
So they vanished off your list.
They'd gone.
Yeah.
They might occasionally say, for a one-off operation, say, we want an SBS guy, you know, to pretend to be a lobster pot in Dublin Harbour or something. Because we haven't got the skills to do it. Then the guy was sent to go and do that, and when he finished, he came back again. Yeah. And all I was required to do was to provide the person, and then sometimes to yay or nay it. Not so much on that side, but often, I mean, in addition, the other requests we got were training. I mean, every country in the world wanted to have special forces.
Yes.
And every country in the world that had any sort of sea interest, of which there are quite a few, wanted to have a sort of miniature SBS. Would we like to go and train them, please? Well, my reaction to that was, multiple. One, do we want to train these guys in our techniques, which they might use against us? Actually, the techniques that we use are so simple that a child of three could think them up. And what actually deters these buggers is the thought that we're so magic that we can sort of fly and walk on water. So that actually puts them off. But if we actually demonstrate that what we do is really quite easy, it won't deter them any longer. And these are the sort of thoughts that I used to parade in front of people.
Psychological deterrent.
Psychological deterrent. Three, if all my people are running around training Arabs, I haven't got enough people to train my own people, let alone enough people to actually do the job that you may require me to do. So, I mean, those are the first three things I always said. you know, and pressure would be coming from the Foreign Office, who wanted to, you know, get kudos out of it,
yeah,
and the MOD, who didn't want to do it anyway, and me, who was ambivalent about it. So again, these are the sort of decisions. I mean, it wasn't my decision in the end. If somebody said, you bloody will do it, I had to do it, but I had to muster the arguments and argue through why we did or did not want to send people to that country. Sometimes there was payoff, there was good training, you know, send them there, but what payback? Okay, can we go and train there? There are chaps there to do an exercise which will benefit us. So all that. So that's why it took up a lot of time, because it was a moving thing. It wasn't like training in the reserves, which on the whole was just sort of, there's the program, you just sort of go on. With Special Forces, it was a moving target, and there was usually a new problem every day.
Now, this is really getting into a semi-political role, isn't it?
Yes, it was, but I wasn't having the final decision.
No.
But I had to muster the arguments and parade them to an audience that maybe hadn't thought about those aspects.
Now, you're mentioning also in training, you mentioned the word bullying. Now, was bullying going on? Was it an issue at that time?
Yeah, there was bullying. I hope there wasn't much. Mm. But there was one case of bullying when I was there.
Was it the sort of lethal bullying that happened in Kashmir?
No, something stupid like... I mean, I can't remember exactly what it was. It was something like... Remember the days we used to paste out targets with, I think the chap made him put his tongue out and sort of painted it with glue or something, which is pretty unpleasant. and he was given demoted, court-martialed and reduced to Marine. And occasionally, and that led me to read the Riot Act, because I didn't know what that else was covering.
Yeah. Well, it's only the tip of the iceberg.
Only the tip of the iceberg. And, you know, it comes from a number of sources. Yes. Well, let me start again. It comes from a number of reasons. And one of them is that, of course, the training now is so bloody soft, isn't it? Like as hard as it was when I went through. It's time I toughen these buggers up. Mm. The answer is actually the training was probably harder then than it was now than it was. Because the pressure's on in time. And they don't need the racking up, the unofficial racking up, the unofficial... business. And I used to say, you know, the training can be hard without any bullying, without any beasting or whatever. Mm. The training is hard because of the nature of the training and the standards we require them to pass. That's hard enough. So let's be content with that.
And related to that, you were looking at training from a different angle
from
when you had started. You were you started at the bottom, obviously, and now you're looking at it from the top.
Yeah.
Had there been any really major changes in the sort of training and the way it was done?
From the time I went through?
From the time you had gone through.
It was far better.
What had been improved then?
It had been improved. The better use was made of time. Mm. Some of the more... I mean, there was far less time spent cleaning buttons, for example. I mean, when I joined... We spent a great deal of time cleaning our kit, because it was kit that needed to be cleaned. So it was less time doing that. There was recognition that you are actually recruiting a different sort of chap. I mean, I think I may have said this at the beginning, but I mean, most of the guys that were young recruits and the first Marines I commanded, or many of them, had been involved in manual labour on the roads or down the mines. Or as brickies apprentices or builders labourers. Most of them had worked with their hands in some way or other, or at a machine. And you're getting less and less of these sort of guys. They're a different breed of people who've played less sport. And therefore you've got to approach them in a different way, which is to build up their fitness from a different level. But you're still going to produce the same sort of person at the end, in fact a better person in my opinion.
So physically they weren't so fit.
No.
But in what ways were they better then, or fitter?
I think they were better in that they were, I wouldn't say more intelligent, but I think they were more worldly wise, because they had been used to, you know, watching television and being accustomed to knowing what was going on. Right, they had inquiring minds, and they weren't just completely dumb, or they wouldn't join the Royal Marines anyway. they were accustomed to being full of information about things and knowing what was going on and having some control over what they were doing.
So they're more aware.
More aware. But the paradox is you're training them for something over which they have no control, which is battle. They're only controlling the bit that goes on around them, not what the enemy is doing to them. So, of course, many of them, their parents had not been in the service. Many of them were not even the sons of chaps who'd been in national service. So they had a different, perhaps, attitude towards life.
So post-military generation.
Post-military generation. And this was the first of it. We're talking about the early 80s.
Did that mean that you had to change the style of discipline? Or the modes of discipline?
I'm just trying to think back to sort of discipline of my